Support for PrayPublic is provided by BNC National Bank, dedicated to providing financial solutions for businesses and consumers throughout the region. More information online at bnc.bank.
Welcome to Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we'll bring you a new episode of Conversations on Healthcare. Co-hosts Margaret Flintner and Mark Maselli sit down with Dr. Aaron Carroll, the new CEO of Academy Health, to discuss the importance of using data and evidence in healthcare and why clear, nuanced communication is vital. But we're kicking off things today with an extraordinary story of an adventure and discovery right here in North Dakota. Seth Varner is our guest, and he has taken on the remarkable task of visiting all 355 cities and towns across the state. Whether it's a quick drive to pick up groceries or a weekend trip to visit the family, we all take road trips in our daily lives, but Seth takes this to the next level, uncovering the unique charm of every corner of North Dakota. Seth Varner, welcome to Main Street.
Hey, Craig. Thanks for having me on and for learning more about Wandermore. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, I'm very interested in learning all about what it is that you do. You have just completed a mission, Seth. You have visited every single incorporated town in North Dakota. I'm going to ask you, why on earth would you do that in just a little bit? But first, I'm just curious, what has surprised you the most about our state?
I'm surprised at how much there actually was to offer up in the Peace Garden State. You know, I had never been up there up until like a couple of years ago. I crossed the border kind of as a joke, just to be like, hey, like, look, I made a wrong turn in South Dakota and somehow ended up here. And I had never been since then. And I was pleased to find that North Dakota has a lot more to offer than people would expect, you know, from the Enchanted Highway to the International Peace Garden and everything in between. There's a lot of cool nature things to see and friendly people to meet and good eats and just tons of stuff to see and do all throughout the state.
Who's the coolest person you met in North Dakota on your journey?
The coolest person? Oh, that's tough. I've met so many. I did meet a guy who appeared on American Pickers from the History Channel. He has like a collection of like antique memorabilia and stuff. And so he kind of showed me like his hidden stash and what some of those guys from the Pickers show had picked up along the way. Brian Nelson out of Tolna is his name. Town of only a couple hundred people up in the Northeast.
So as you travel around North Dakota, you come into one of these communities. What do you do?
So the main goal of my project was to first document town history. So, you know, like back in the day, like 1910s, 1920s, even like up through the 50s, like they would take these postcard shots of old buildings and main streets and the like. So, you know, most people nowadays don't go around their towns taking pictures of like all the businesses, churches and whatnot. Like you might have some here or there, but I'm kind of that guy in like the modern time. So I went around and I would photograph every single building of note that wasn't a private residence. And that even includes like parks and monuments and stuff too. So first and foremost, I would do that. And then I'd also want to try to promote some of the small town tourism. So I might meet with like the local mayor or some other folks that want to show me their business. I might get a meal at a local restaurant or visit like a historic site. And I just kind of did like a mix of things just to get kind of like a feel for each community and see what made it unique in its own way.
Then do you want to write about each and every community? What do you do next? Why do you do all this, Seth?
So I am the CEO of Wandermore Publishing. It sounds fancy and all, but I'm literally the only guy within the company. I project myself this big book publishing company. And it's just a 24-year-old out of Nebraska running the whole thing. But I publish a travel guide history book when I'm done visiting each town and each state. And the goal of the book is essentially just to show like, hey, the Midwest is more than a bunch of flyover states and there's stuff doing each one of our communities. And so I'll go into some of the details about things you can see and do in each town, like restaurants, golf courses, like National Register places, like, you know, everything you can think of to do, like in little towns throughout the state. And a lot of the book is history as well. So I talk about how like towns got their names, maybe some of the early businesses, maybe some notable folks from there. It's kind of just like this big comprehensive book to the state where people can learn more about North Dakota, find the encouragement to go out and visit some of these towns for themselves.
You've done this in other states too.
Yeah. So it started back in Nebraska in 2020. So that's home for me. I'm talking to y'all from Omaha right now, but I grew up in a smaller town called Wahoo, which we're known for being the home office of David Letterman back in the 90s. It's kind of our claim to fame, but yeah. Cause we gave away two of the town teenagers and we gave them like a wall clock. We had a cow manure and I think we gave him a car or a motorcycle or something too. Like, it was before my time, but I've read in the story and it's kind of funny to see, like, hey, we gave this guy his own office, and it's just a telephone booth in Main Street. Wahoo. That's a quote unquote office. I started back in Nebraska in 2020, and since then I've been to the other four states along the way, and I want to say it's like 2,700 odd communities altogether that I've had the pleasure of visiting and touring over the last half decade or so.
Seth, let me just tell you what's on my mind. I can see you having a beer with a friend and losing a bet. Am I far off from there?
You know, not necessarily. It's like, it was kind of one of these things where, like, it came up in conversation. It's like, it dates back to like 2010 even. Like, my dad and I had kind of gone around, visit some towns. Like, I was like a third grader at the time, and he was taking pictures of like churches and cemeteries and things that were relevant, like, to our family tree and like genealogy. And so me as a 10-year-old, I was like, oh, like, dad, you should take me to every town someday. And, you know, him being a busy guy and me being 10, it was like, well, of course, like, he's not going to take his kid to every town in the state. But I kind of threw that idea in the back of my head. And then COVID came around, and my buddy and I were so bored. We were working at Dairy Queen, and, you know, with COVID, there's just nothing to do. And, like, just truly everything was closed. And so I kind of thought that idea from when I was a kid. I was like, we should go to every town in the state, like, just cause. Like, let's make a something out of nothing summer. It's like, I'm tired of, like, I'm tired of sitting at home and playing video games and working out and eating ice cream at Dairy Queen. It's like, this is kind of getting old. Let's go actually do something. And from there, we just took off. And, you know, I only made a Facebook page because my mom wanted to see some of my pictures along the way. And then some of you folks with the media started reaching out, and things got a little crazy after that. So
you've been around to North Dakota. You've seen all the communities. You've done this in other states as well. Seth, have you noticed, I guess, any patterns or commonalities that towns and our cities have with other towns and other cities that you've visited around the region?
You know, I think Midwest hospitality is a real thing. That's probably been the common thread I found through all five states, is just that everyone is willing to do whatever they can to support you in whatever you're doing. I'll show up in these towns, and it's like, I would get quote unquote, like, pulled over by the residents because they see this out of state license plate taking pictures of their downtown. They're like, hey, can we help you with something? Like, anything we can do for you? And I would talk about my mission and what I was doing, documenting their community and, like, promoting the tourism. And they'd be like, oh, well, that's fantastic. Like, well, if you need somewhere to stay, like, we'll put you up in our basement. Or are you hungry? Like, we can take you out to the bar for a meal. Or, oh, let me top off your tank for you. Met tons of those people along the way. And everyone was just really kind and willing to help me out in any possible way that they could. And, you know, that didn't range even just monetarily even. It'd be like, maybe they'd get me in the museum that was closed otherwise. Or, you know, maybe they'd introduce me to the town mayor then, or something along those lines.
We're enjoying our conversation with Seth Varner of Wandermore Publishing. It's a publishing company that creates books to encourage individuals to go out and explore their home states. And that's really the basis for what you do, correct? You want people to go out and about.
Yeah, because, I mean, I truly believe there's something to do in every little town across the Midwest. It's like, you know, Midwesterners, we kind of have this stigma where it's like, all we got is the church and the bar in town. Like, there's nothing else to do around here. It's like, people think the Midwest is kind of monotonous and that it has to be the same thing every day. But I would argue that there's so much more to see and do. It's like, you know, in North Dakota, for example, you've got your bigger attractions like, oh, the Enchanted Highway. And you've got like the Lawrence Welk historic side, and you got some of those things. But a lot of folks I found like actually haven't been like to their own county museum, or they haven't been to the bar in the town over. And it'll be the best food they've ever had. Or people are into geocaching. They can go visit the local cemeteries and find the geocaches there and learn a little history. Beautiful churches all over the state. You know, I think North Dakota is more wildlife refuges than any other state in the union. So there's just a big range of things to see and do all throughout the Peace Garden State. And it's been kind of my mission to showcase like, hey, like, if you're willing to drive 5, 50, maybe even 100 miles, like, you'll find that there's a lot of stuff to do in your immediate vicinity where you don't necessarily have to plan an entire week or month trip out of it. Like, you can just go for a day trip on the weekend and find something close to home that might be your new favorite spot.
Seth, as somebody who documents local history and architecture and culture, is it a challenge for you then to capture the whole essence of a community and tie it all together in a presentable way? And how do you How do you do that? What resonates today with the people you want to reach?
It is difficult to try to show off like an entire community just in like a single Facebook post. I try my best to kind of capture everything I can each community and kind of get some different aspects of each. But I understand too, like on my own, like I can't do everything by myself as one individual, but through what I share, I can encourage others to as a cumulative group to go out and do the same. I think between all of us, maybe between all of our lifetimes, we can experience all that North Dakota has to offer. But I do my best to do a little research on like the history of the town. And I think putting it all together, like sharing the old history of the town and then putting it with modern pictures kind of shows like, okay, every community was once this bustling, you know, most of them were railroad towns and had their own lines of businesses and infrastructure and fraternal organizations and everything else along those lines. And to see how they have evolved into the modern day and kind of share it in a post that highlights the old but promotes the new, I think it inspires a lot of pride in people and helps spur a lot of memories for those who have maybe moved away. It's been enjoyable for me on Facebook even to share pictures of old businesses and grain elevators and the like and see people's comments where they're like, oh yeah, my Uncle Tony dropped off grain there 60 years ago. I remember playing there and, oh, I remember when that was the bar. And then I promote the local businesses and people are talking all about like, oh, like this is my favorite little flower shop on this side of the Mississippi River. And, you know, like things like that where people take pride in what's in their community now and what was there before.
Seth, I'm guessing that you've met a lot of people like I would see my dad. My dad would see you and say, hey, have you been here? Let's go. Have you been there? Let's go and introduce you to everybody in town. But those are people of now my generation, older folks. Are you able to connect with younger folks too as you're getting out and about?
I have been here and there actually, which kind of surprises me because it's like, so I share all my stuff on Facebook. You know, kind of the cliche, it's like Facebook's for older folks, but in my generation is more on like TikTok, Instagram, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of people my age that I did connect with along the way, just through like even mutual friends. Like I'm trying to think. So my buddy worked for a baseball team called the Oahe Zap, and they're in the same baseball league as like I think it's the Badlands Big Sticks out of Dickinson is their name, and there's another team up north there as well. But I met some college students along the way who took an interest in my project, and so at NDSU and the University of North Dakota, I got to talk to some people my age, and even within tourism, it's like there's a lot of people in their 20s who are actually maybe not like the head of the chamber, but they're like working to become a director within it. They work in economic development, promoting people to come to their towns. And I think of like Valley City was a good example where I met these two young ladies who were really passionate about their job. And they were pretty adamant. They were just like you described, like on Facebook, they're like, when are you coming to Valley City? It's like, we want to show you around. Like we want to make sure you find all the highlights and everything. And People definitely have the same mindset across generations where they have that small town pride, and they definitely wanted to share all of it with me.
Is there any place that you, I've got to go there, but I just don't want to. I don't want to go there because of whatever reason.
So I've talked about documenting the towns, right? How I take pictures like every like business, church, etc. So when you get to bigger towns like a Fargo or a Bismarck, it's like that kind of goes out the window where it's like, you know, it's like, I know I can't photograph literally every single thing and like those towns. So I try to focus on the highlights, not completely overwhelm myself. Like, don't get me wrong. Like I had a blast in Fargo, Bismarck, Minot, Williston, Grand Forks, like all those bigger communities, did lots of stuff in each. But I always found that I kind of enjoyed the smaller communities more. Like the smaller the population and the more stuff was there, kind of the bigger the interest I took, because it's just neat to see how these single digit population and municipalities can carry on. Like there are these, you know, substantial communities, and maybe they'll keep up like several churches and a bar. And I keep going back to the bar thing, but it's true, it's like the highlight of many small towns. But I wouldn't say I dreaded anything though. I definitely kept in the back of my mind like, okay, like I know I can't do everything, so I'll just do a smidgen of each here and there. But
how do you monetize this? How do you make money?
So that's a good question. A lot of folks are wondering how I'm able to gallivant around all the time, as some of them put it. But there's three different ways mainly. So I've talked about, I have those other travel guides for Nebraska, Iowa, South Dakota, and Kansas. And actually, just in the past week, I've surpassed 10,000 cumulative sales across those four books, which is just amazing that that many people want to take an interest in my work. And I've encouraged that many folks to pick up a book and go travel the states for themselves. So I use old book sale money. That's enough to like help pay my rent and some basic life needs while going out on the road for gas and hotels and all that stuff. And then, you know, kind of how like YouTubers make money off their videos, like that's been a more recent thing off like advertisements and that kind of thing. Facebook has a content creator program, which I'm very thankful they rolled out with a couple years ago. They kind of rolled out to compete with like other big social media companies like TikTok and Snapchat, some of their rivals. But they pay me a fraction of a penny for each like, comment, share, etc. Basically just as a reward for like making good content for Facebook. In a world where there's a lot of craziness out there, I think they like to help out like photographers and those of us who are sharing some good out there on the internet. And so that's way number two. And then the third way is through the Wandermore Travel Fund. So in these forthcoming books, I do an acknowledgement section where I allow people for every $5 that they donate to put a name of their choosing in the back of my forthcoming book for life. And so what a lot of folks do is like they'll send $10 over to help me with gas and car repairs and the like. And they'll say, write in memory of grandma and grandpa. Or sure. They'll say, oh, I want all my kids' names in the book or my business or something. And I just kind of let people put whatever they want in there. And I print it up, and it's my promise to them that I will print that in every subsequent edition of the book for life. And it's kind of a tribute to those who helped me along the way then.
So do you enjoy, Seth, more writing or using, you know, a camera to photograph, or do you video too? What do you enjoy the most there? And then on the creating side afterwards, after you visited a place, is it the writing? Is it the photography? Is it the artistic part of what it is that you want to do?
You know, so I got really lucky with Wandermore, and it's a culmination of all my passions. So I love history and writing. Like, I was almost an English and history teacher at one point. Both majors I had considered at one point. I ended up getting the business major, and so that's where that kind of rolls in. Like, I love business and just like the marketing sales aspects. That's what my degree is in. Then you combine that with my passions of like photography and travel, and social media even. And so I've always kind of been intrigued by like the whole content creation thing and graphic design. So you combine my six or seven major life passions into this one project, and I enjoy all of it, but I think what I like most is actually going to towns themselves. It's definitely the travel aspect. I've always been a big travel kid, and I've been planning my family vacation since I was like 14 years old. Like, I would pick out the stops, even like the hotels or the Airbnbs and whatnot along the way, and kind of choose our activities and like. And so for me to actually plan out these trips and then go and, you know, visit maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 communities over the course of a week, like, it's a lot of fun for me to carry that out and see for myself, like, what makes this town unique in its own way. It's like, you can read about it online, you can look at TripAdvisor, you can see someone else's Facebook post, but until you get there for yourself, you don't really know what it's like. And it's been pretty amazing for me to be able to tour, you know, nearly 3,000 odd towns over the course of my life and kind of see what makes them special. So I would say travel, and definitely the photography aspect too, is I'm pretty big on taking pictures, and I love finding the perfect angles, perfect shots, and showing off buildings in their best light.
Thousands and thousands of towns, but you are not done, Seth. What's next?
So I want to get to every town in at least 10 states. I just got engaged this last May.
Congratulations.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
Does she know you're never home, by the way?
What's that?
Does she know you're never home, right? You're out and about all the time? Whoops. Are you still?
Oh, I cut out.
You're back. Go ahead.
I'm back.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was that last bit?
The question is, does your fiance know that you are gone a lot?
Does she know? Oh, man. Yeah, she notices when I'm out of the apartment for a week. I think she kind of likes the time off on her own, but she definitely misses me, and she's always looking forward to me coming back. But she actually got to join me on this last trip in the southwestern part of the state. And so just this last week, we got to go tour both units of Theodore Roosevelt National Park and the Medora Musical. And went to Dickinson and Bismarck and toured the Capitol and all that stuff. So she got pretty lucky with a pretty touristy part of the state and
for
got
sure.
to tag along. But she had a blast, and we've been talking about it. And I'm hoping down the road, like, you know, before we have kids, like before she's out of school and everything, that I can get to every incorporated town in at least 10 states is the goal. She's a big proponent for Montana. That's her favorite state. She loves Glacier National Park and just the rolling hills and just kind of the emptiness of the state. It's just very calming, very unique. And we've talked about maybe going there where she could join me all the towns of Montana. But other states I've considered is like Oklahoma and Minnesota and Missouri and more of the surrounding states, Nebraska. So I haven't made an official decision yet. I'm kind of leaning towards Oklahoma because, like, traditionally I've kind of gone north-south. And so it would make sense for me to finish off the central states with the exception of Texas. And hopefully we can get to every town in at least 10 of them. And I guess we'll see where life has me at that point.
Texas would seem daunting to me, by the way.
So I don't know about that one.
They've so got large.
1,500 towns.
Oh, my goodness.
It's all cities. And I don't know about Texas, but...
Throw my home state on there, would you? Wyoming. I think you would enjoy that.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, well, I have thought about Wyoming.
They right next door to you, bud.
99 incorporated municipalities. I might do Wyoming. Like, that's one of those where I'm like, I think I need to do it because there's so few towns. It's so unique. I think it'd be an easy one to knock out. Like, it's still 99 towns and it's 3-hour drives between each. But
so how do you see Wandermore Publishing evolving in the next year or two as technology evolves, as we consume media evolves? What do you see maybe changing or are becoming new?
So with Wandermore, I'm kind of unique in that I actually don't do like ebooks. I only do paperbacks. And I think that's something to do with just being able to hold a book while you're on the road, being able to thumb through it and read about the history of the towns and even tour them vicariously, like through the book. So like one cool thing I do is like, okay, so I took 39 pictures of North Dakota, right? I have over 39,000 pictures of the state. And it's like, how do you possibly put that many pictures in a single book? Like, it's just not possible, right? So I came up with the idea to use QR codes, you know, kind of a modern twist where it's like, you see it now in restaurants and graduation programs and even on TV and commercials, you're starting to see more and more QR codes pop up, like scan here for more information. So what I do is I incorporate those in my books and people can scan a QR code and they can essentially vicariously tour any one of the communities I did in North Dakota. Like I know like in Minot and Fargo and some of those towns, I took like 800 pictures. None of and 700 of those didn't make it onto Facebook because of the 100 photo limit. And so people can then actually see every single picture that I took via those books. That's a big kind of unique thing with Wandermore is I allow people to do that and I give access to all my photos and I don't restrict a lot outside the book. And otherwise, I'm going to keep up with the Facebook pages and I've got 5 of them right now. And so I'm one guy managing 5 pages and I post pretty much daily on each one. That's the plan for now is I'll keep making a new page for each state. I'll keep up with the QR codes in the books and just trying to do more and more history and more travel information and just make them as useful as I can and try to encourage as many people as possible to go and explore.
Traveler and author Seth Varner works to document town history through his writings and photographs. He likes to learn more about local communities and then encourage the expansion of small towns through tourism. He is the CEO of Wandermore Publishing. Seth, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for getting to know more about my project. And it's been a blast touring North Dakota. I'm looking forward to Wyoming, Montana, Oklahoma, whatever comes next down the road.
Seth, if people want to learn more, where should they go?
They can check out my Facebook page, Wandermore North Dakota, if you'd like to see where I've been. You can see all my photos and write-ups from the 355 towns I visited. The book will be out this November, Thanksgiving week, and that'll be available on my website at wandermorepublishing.com.
Best wishes, Seth. Thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, the importance of using data and evidence in healthcare. That's after this.
Tour the studios of some of Fargo Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, and more, all demonstrating their work. Find the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Conversations on Healthcare, co-hosts Margaret Flintner and Mark Mazzelli sit down with Dr. Aaron Carroll, the new CEO of Academy Health, to discuss the importance of using data and evidence in healthcare and why clear, nuanced communication is vital in an era of conflicting health advice.
Well, Dr. Collins, thank you for being with us again as a guest on Conversations on Healthcare.
Glad to join you and to talk about this topic and anything else that's on your mind.
Oh, that's great. Well, we really enjoyed our recent conversation with Renee Fleming about the book. And she told us about the small dinner you attended a few years ago with a number of dignitaries, including three Supreme Court justices, and how she helped the group join together in song. And why was that occasion so meaningful to you that you wrote about it in the foreword to Renee's book?
Well, for two reasons. One was it was the first time I met Renee, and she's now becoming a wonderful colleague and a partner in everything we're trying to do about music and the mind. The other was it was just an amazingly compelling example of how music can transform the way in which people interact with each other and can bring us together as a group, even at times where people were not necessarily in that mindset. Because this was kind of a tense meeting. It was just a day or two after the Supreme Court had announced their decision about gay marriage. And at dinner were three Supreme Court justices who had not been on the same side of this. And so it was a little tense. Everybody was trying to behave themselves, but you didn't get the sense that everybody in the room was necessarily feeling happy. And we, after dinner, went outside to get a little fresh air because it was a summer evening. And there was a fairly routine bluegrass band that was playing off to the side. The meeting organizer had asked me to bring my guitar because I am a musician of an amateur sort, and I happen to know a lot of bluegrass tunes. So I decided to join in with the band. And then this stunning, well-dressed woman came up and said, you know, maybe it would help if we sang something. And I realized it was Renee Fleming, who I'd never met before. And I was immediately terrified that she was expecting a Puccini aria, which was not in my particular repertory. I need not have worried. Renee Fleming has an incredibly eclectic ability to capture almost any style of music. And she knew a lot of traditional folk songs, which I also know. And so, yeah, we just decided, okay, let's take this and see where it goes. And within, you know, two or three songs, the whole sense of the evening had changed. People who were looking pretty stiff were laughing, they were relaxed, they were singing along. It just made an obvious difference in how we all got along with each other. And that's what music can do. So after that, Renee told me that she was about to start a special ambassadorship at the Kennedy Center, and she was looking for specific things that she might plunge into as far as projects. And so we cooked up this idea of let's get the music therapists and the neuroscientists together and see what they could learn from each other. And now we've been at that for 7 years, and it's been pretty amazing to see how it's evolved. And that book that she edited is a great compendium of a lot of the things and the ideas that have come along, some of them before we started this 7 years ago, but a lot of it since then.
But I want to ask you maybe to explain to us the current state of the science around the clinical applications of music or music therapy. You've written that music may have evolutionary advantages to us, but certainly it's really in the mainstream as an application to health and to healing. So tell us about the current state of the science on this.
There's a lot to say there. Maybe just to begin with the basic understanding of how music affects us, because we know it does. I mean, there are pieces of music. I know if somebody starts playing those, I'm going to get a chill. I might get a little choked up because it just taps into something. And we're tapping out what exactly is happening in the brain when that happens. There's some very interesting findings about how our brains really are specially designed for musical tones in a way that doesn't happen by accident. It must have had some evolutionary advantage. And it's not just hearing, like you could hear voices or street noises. There's something about an actual musical tone, a particular frequency, that our brains are prepared to receive in a special way. There's a neurosurgeon in San Francisco who does surgery on patients with epilepsy, where you have to open the skull and put electrodes all across the top of the brain, waiting for a seizure to happen. So you'll see exactly where is it starting. And that's the place you need to go and take care of. But oftentimes you have to wait for a few days for a seizure to happen. So during that time, you go to those patients and say, would you be interested in taking part in a clinical trial? Most of them say, yeah, I'm just lying here. And so you ask them to think about something or do some motor activity or receive some input. And in this case, it's music. And he learned from doing this that there are actually three different circuits in the acoustic cortex, the part of the brain that actually processes sound right here in your temple. And there's one that actually responds to pitch. So it's like, okay, that's an F sharp. And you know, somebody with perfect pitch will know that's an F sharp. But all of us know, okay, that's sort of a high or a low note. And then there's another circuit that responds to the interval, the difference between that note and the one before it. Was that a big jump or a little jump? And the one that really surprised me is the third circuit is an anticipatory circuit. It's telling you what the next note is probably going to be. And I didn't know that would be there, but come to think of it, if you're used to a particular style of music and you're hearing a song for the first time, sometimes you're pretty good at guessing where that melody is going because there's a certain convention about what comes after what, and your brain has already computed that for you. And that was pretty stunning. Those kinds of things are happening, as well as figuring out how then that signal gets tapped into deeper parts of the brain that are involved in emotion and memory. All of this is greatly facilitated by the fact that NIH is in the process of taking apart a lot of the complexities of how the brain works with those 86 billion neurons you have between your ears, each of which has maybe 1,000 connections, making that about the most complicated structure in the known universe, and really trying to figure out how those circuits work. And combining that with how music affects those circuits is pretty interesting, still very much a work in progress. But I think if we understood that in great detail, then music therapy, which at the moment is mostly empirical, could start to be really much more based upon a deep understanding of brain circuits and how they can influence response that you need for somebody who has chronic pain or somebody who has PTSD or somebody, a child with autism or an adult who's beginning to slip into dementia. But then there's a lot of clinical applications that we're intensively studying. One of them is chronic pain and how do you help people who are suffering without having to prescribe pain medicines, many of which you really don't want to be on for a long period of time, especially narcotics. And it's pretty clear there are distinct benefits from music therapy, musical training. A study that I was particularly intrigued by took people who had chronic pain, mostly elderly folks with difficulties with back pain or arthritis, and put them into two groups. Both of them got voice training. One of them was solo voice training, somebody who's going to teach you how to sing so it sounds good. The other was putting them in a choir. And both of them, I think, were trained for like 12 weeks. And then they measured a whole lot of aspects of how those people's general sense of well-being was going. And I don't know what you would guess, the people in the choir had by far the best response. The solo singers did a little better than if they'd done nothing, but the choir people, basically their sense of chronic pain was significantly reduced. Their sense of well-being, their generosity, which you could sort of measure by various scales, went up. And you could even measure things in their bloodstream like oxytocin and see that it had gone up as a good indication of well-being. So that's fascinating that this clearly was both music, but it was probably also social interaction. You put the two together, you got a great thing there that didn't require anybody taking a pill.
Well, that is so fascinating. And pull a little thread about how the circuits work, because you've really been focusing under your watch at NIH. They funded 21 research grants investigating art and music therapy, and maybe you've been sharing some of those with us. Anything else you'd like to tell us about the funding and what it has highlighted?
I think it's across the board. There's certainly been grants looking at childhood benefits of music education. And it's quite clear that intense exposure to music as a child also enhances your language development and your school performance, mm-hmm. and probably also mathematics. These are all kind of linked together, which makes it particularly unfortunate that many schools have eliminated music education, considering that just to be a frill in a time of tough budgets. It's not a frill. It clearly has significant benefits on childhood learning. I started learning music at age 4. I don't know if that had something to do with the fact that I also was pretty comfortable with language and mathematics, but they were all tied together in my experience. And a lot of kids don't get to have that chance, or it's delayed until much later. And clearly early exposure to music, particularly for language development, helps a lot. We have well-documented studies to show that. And then there are, of course, studies on various conditions that you want to see how can music help. Particularly interesting application in Parkinson's disease. Hmm. You know, people with Parkinson's disease have this neurological problem that inhibits their ability to initiate some kind of motor movement, including just walking across the room or walking across the street. They sort of are stuck, and it's hard to get started. And then once they do get started, they're often moving at a pretty slow pace. It turns out just simply having a beat, a drum beat, synchronizes with their brain in a way that allows them to overcome that inhibition. And a particularly interesting study that I just heard about back in December was that it turns out that you don't have to have somebody play that drum beat for you. It will also work if you have a song that goes at a particular pace and you imagine that in your head. And if you have Parkinson's disease and it's time to cross the street, kick your song in the brain and off you go.
Well, it is truly fascinating. And I guess the question from your perspective, are we doing enough to examine the effects of music input on the brain and maybe not just music, but other non-pharmacologic, non-surgical interventions, music, dance, social connection? Tell us your thoughts about that when we think about the impact that we're seeing of music.
I think there's a lot more we could be doing. The Brain Initiative, I think by necessity, first had to try to build the basic science understanding of mm-hmm. what actually are the cells in the brain and how are they connected to each other. That's been a pretty amazing experience over the course of the last few years. You know, we used to look at the brain and look at the cells in the brain and imagine that there might be maybe a dozen or so different cell types that had different functions in different parts of the brain. Now, with this concept, which has become reduced to practice, of single cell biology, where you can look at a single cell and ask it what it's doing by asking what genes do you have turned on or off, you can really begin to understand the heterogeneity of the cells that are in the brain. And a lot of things we thought were the same are actually quite significantly differentiated into special activities. So the most recent analysis, this atlas of the human brain, catalogs over 3,000 different types of cells, each of which has a different type of function. So we're starting to learn just how complicated this is, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised when you consider what the brain can do. But it's a first step, then, in really beginning to understand function, is to at least know who are the players in this game and what exactly are their assignments. And that is starting to emerge. And on top of that, more technologies that allow you to determine not just what one cell is doing, but a circuit of a million cells that are all working together. What is that about? How do you lay down a memory? How do you retrieve it again? We're starting to close in on answers to those long-standing questions that through all of human history people have wondered about, and we may now be able to figure that out. So all of that information is going to help. But of course, that's sort of a foundation for understanding sort of the brain at rest. And then you want to know what happens with external stimuli that come in, and music being a fascinating example, but not the only one. Also, all of the things that happen around us in terms of social interactions, how does that tie in to our sense of who we are and what motivation we have, what our sense of our own desire, not just to be selfish characters, but to actually interact with other people in ways that are more generous. Now, I think we're going to start to figure those things out, but those are really complicated issues. For me as a physician, I hope the applications, particularly to people who are suffering, can be on the front burner and we can move those forward as fast as we can. And I think that's a lot of what the Music in the Mind project at NIH is now focused on. We spent about $25 million since this program started on specific grants. We've now sort of moved it more into a place of having a consortium working on a particular problem instead of a single investigator. So there's one on pain, and there's one on early onset Alzheimer's disease and how to help people in that situation, and aging in general. How can music help in that space? But we could be doing a lot more. One of the things Renee is really focused on, and I'm all in favor of this, is to be sure we're doing the right thing to train the next generation, to get people excited about this. This is a historic moment to bring together music and the arts together with science in a way that sometimes don't seem to know how to talk to each other. Now we can change that with an opportunity to make some real observations that are going to help people. But I want to be sure that next generation is aware there's a pathway here that they might want to be involved in. A lot of scientists are musicians, but most of them think, well, that's going to have to be something we compartmentalized. I'll do science over here and I'll do music over there. Hey, how about we get a few people to do both at the same time for their professional life? I think there could be some pretty spectacular outcomes of that if we make it clear that that is now possible.
Well, what an exciting time we're living in science. We could do a whole show on this and how the applications of AI might be the generative AI might be helpful on that. But I really want to get to the point that you and Renee both talked about. And she shared with us the skepticism supporters face when they talk about music in the mind. And you write about the fear that serious scientific community would not take the idea of music therapy seriously. Hard to believe with Dr. Frances Collins or Renee Fleming, really, and that wonderful book that she edited, really walking through so many brilliant people who wrote about it. But tell us more about how we can overcome that in addition to the work that you and Renee are doing.
So, yeah, I think it helps that a lot of scientists are people who love and oftentimes perform music, that this is sort of tapping into that. But there is still some element of, oh, this is fluff. This isn't really serious science that people will throw back at you. And they will look at the field of music therapy and say, you know, that's all very fine, but it's just anecdotal. Mm-hmm. One of the things we're trying to do with Music in the Mind is to actually add some additional rigor to the music therapy field. We have a whole toolbox now for people who are doing research on whether music therapy for a particular condition is providing a particular benefit. So you really have the rigorous data to show that this wasn't just a feel-good moment. It actually changed outcomes. And that's a big step forward for a field that hasn't previously, for the most part, had those kinds of rigorous standards to adhere to. But it's also the way that if we can get this to work and show those benefits, that ultimately remuneration from third parties is going to be more possible. The music therapists, of course, for the most part, aren't very well compensated. So it's to their best benefit, but it's to the benefit of all of us. If we can figure out how to turn this into a well-established, evidence-based approach to conditions where you know it's going to provide benefit and therefore should be paid for.
What can we do to keep this feeling alive, particularly among the diverse population of this country? I will add, you're also the champion of the All of Us, which really is looking to reflect all of America. And so thank you for all of that. But really talk a little bit about how we make sure that is there a diverse population coming up who will lead the next way, who will solve those scientific complexities that you talked about earlier.
And we need that next population, and we need them to be diverse. We know in every field, including science, diversity improves productivity. If everybody has exactly the same mindset, well, maybe we don't need everybody. We just need a person. But if you have a diverse group with a different approach to a problem, and certainly figuring out how music can affect health is a problem where people will have lots of different views based on their own cultural experience. And we want to tap into that in every possible way. So NIH is very much in that space of trying to be sure that all those recruitment programs are reaching out in ways that maybe haven't been as fully empowered as they should be. And certainly for anybody who's listening to this or hearing about it, this is a golden time to be involved in biomedical research, whether it's a deep investigation of how the brain works or whether it's something about social and human behavior and how that can enhance our health and everything in between. We are on an exponential curve of new knowledge acquisition that is breathtaking to be part of. And so people who are thinking about, well, how do I want to spend my professional life? This is a lot more fun, I think, than being a banker. A lot more fun than most of the other jobs I could think of, because you're making a discovery all the time. And you're part of teams that are working together with ideas floating around and hypotheses that can be generated and tested. This is the moment. If you wanted to be involved in this kind of science, today's the day. So I'm hoping that despite all of the other sort of negative aspects about what's happening in our society right now, with all of the divisiveness and all of the vitriol that flies around on social media, people can kind of rise above that and say, here's something genuinely good. This is a noble enterprise to understand how the human body works and apply that to relieve suffering, reduce pain, and extend people's lifespan and health span. You can be part of that.
Well, Dr. Collins, we want to thank you for your public service, for your scientific contributions, and for all that you have contributed, including a large dose of optimism about what we can and should be doing in health and healthcare and science. Your foreword is in the book, Music and Mind, Harnessing the Arts for Health and Wellness. It's published by Penguin Random House. We want to thank our audience for being here with us. And please be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please do share your thoughts and comments about this program. Dr. Collins, thank you again. Such a pleasure to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thank you both for a really interesting conversation.
That's co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner in their series, Conversation on Healthcare. They bring forth four decades of experience in overcoming the barriers that block access to care in their work at community health centers. Their conversations with creative thinkers and doers from all parts of the field enlighten and inspire all who believe that healthcare is a right and not a privilege.
This is Dakota Daybook for August 27th. As the 19th century turned into the 20th, German immigrants found a promising home in the United States. Many of them moved to the Great Plains, where they broke ground and established farms. They found a comfortable and stable home where opportunities abounded. Many German Americans rose to positions of influence. Others became successful businessmen. That changed when the United States declared war on Germany in 1917, entering World War I. Anti-German sentiment came out into the open. German composers were removed from concert programs. Restaurants took hamburgers off the menu and replaced them with Liberty sandwiches. Sauerkraut became Liberty cabbage, and Frankfurters turned into hot dogs. The American Kennel Club changed the name of the German Shepherd to Shepherd Dog. Berlin, California became Geneva, and Berlin, Iowa became Lincoln. The German language was also a target. German language newspapers were run out of business. Some towns enacted laws making it illegal to speak German in public. Schools canceled classes in German. On this date, in 1918, the Cass County School Superintendent sought to clarify whether the German language was banned in North Dakota schools. Attorney General Langer said there was no such policy, but Superintendent Riley said he had received an order that no school instruction of whatever nature in the German language will be allowed in North Dakota, and compliance with this order must be immediate. Riley actually closed the school in Amenia to comply with the order, but he ran into a snag when he tried to enforce the ruling against a German Lutheran school in Pontiac Township. The Attorney General refused to support the superintendent, declaring that the Council of Defense had never issued such an order. Unable to get answers from government officials, Riley made the matter public by way of the newspapers, doing so when he came under criticism for allowing the German school to continue, but that the fault did not lie with him. Instead, he blamed the Attorney General. The newspaper article noted that Langer deflected blame away from himself, saying the head stenographer sent out the order without authorization, He said he was sincerely sorry that Mrs. Clayton took this authority upon herself. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll dissect the Bush Foundation's grant and fellowship program. Their team is searching for North Dakota folks who have a good idea that could be worth up to $150,000 in Bush Foundation funding. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.